Tuesday before I came into church. I was looking on the internet, reading the news, and I saw the headline that there was white smoke over the Sistine Chapel, but the name of the new pope had not been yet announced. So I went into the bedroom and turned on the TV, and along with the rest of the world, watched as the announcement was finally made in Latin, Habemus Popum. We have a pope. And then the name of the new pope was announced, the name that I was hoping not to hear, frankly, the name of Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, a 78-year-old German theologian who for many years has been one of the most forceful and most conservative voices in the Roman Catholic Church. And in reflecting on what that event was like for me, I wasn't angry, because I don't have any right to be angry about what another church, what another denomination decides to do, but I was disappointed. And I wasn't surprised by the choice. In fact, because it came so quickly, I rather anticipated that this is the name I was going to hear, but I was saddened by this choice, because it seems to me that the human race and that the church is standing at the brink of one of those critical strategic moments in the history of the world. A moment at which either we will learn to make the next evolutionary step in our spiritual development and learn how to build bridges of understanding among the different traditions, or else the hardened fundamentalist religious ideologies of the world will destroy us all by their intolerance. And I just am not convinced that this is the right person to lead the church forward in this critical time. And I hope I'm wrong, and I pray that I'm wrong. But my sense is that the church needed and needs a more prophetic voice that might be open to changes that need to happen. You might know that we're in the midst of a series of sermons that I'm going to be preaching on the parables of Jesus. And today we heard three parables from the 15th chapter of the Gospel of Luke. And by the way, I set them up in the readings. I hope you could hear the parallelism in the way that Luke put these parables, the parable of the lost sheep, the parable of the lost coin, and the parable of the lost son. And in each of these stories, something is lost, then what is lost is found, and then there is a great celebration. I'd like to focus today on the parable of the lost son that we otherwise know as the parable of the prodigal son. Jesus tells a story about a family. And we hear about the father, and we hear about the older son, and we hear about the younger son. There could well be other members of that family, a mother and daughters and other sons and wives and grandchildren and servants. It's a large family, a large household. And the father, of course, is the patriarch of the family. He owns the farm. Everybody gives deference to him. He is the authority figure. And the oldest son has a pretty good deck of cards to play with. He knows that all he has to do is stay at home and do what is expected, obey his father, work on the farm, observe the boundaries of his tradition. And one day he is going to inherit the bulk of the family farm. He is going to be the leader of the family in the next generation. He is going to be the one that everybody pays deference to. And so what's best for him is simply to stay there and do exactly what the tradition tells him he ought to do. But the younger son doesn't have as attractive a set of possibilities. Because of the laws of primogeniture, the younger son will only inherit a small percentage of the father's estate. And he won't own the farm. He won't be as wealthy as his brother. He will always have to give respect and deference to his brother. He will always have to work for his brother on the family farm. And it seems to him that life has got to have more in it for him. He wants to explore different possibilities. He wants to go out into the world and see what else the world might have to offer him. And so he does what is relatively common in the first century. A younger child who asks for their share of the inheritance and receives it and goes out into the world to try to make a new life. And I can imagine the father standing there as his son walks off down the road with the coins jingling in his pocket, going off to the big city to live life, to experiment, to explore. And I can imagine that there was a lot of sadness and pain in the heart of that father watching the son walk away and knowing full well that he was going to make mistakes, that he was going to have good experiences, but that he was going to have painful experiences, that he was going to suffer setbacks, that he might experience a lot of suffering in his life. I imagine the father anticipated something of what might have happened, knowing his son, and knowing maybe what he was like and what he might have wanted to do when he was that age. And sure enough, the son went off, went to a country far away, and with that pocket full of money, he had a good old time. He explored life. He had a lot of different kinds of experiences he had never known about before. He experienced things that were not there to experience back on the old farm. And he acquired some wisdom along the way, the hard way. He acquired some economic wisdom, namely that if one expends one's capital at a greater rate than one is bringing it in, it doesn't bode well for your financial future. And he ended up broke and hungry and maybe feeling like a failure. He had had this chance to make a different life for himself, and he had blown it. But he didn't give up. He didn't ask for charity. He tried to pull himself up by the bootstraps. He got himself a job, an entry-level job, working for one of the leading citizens of that country, taking care of the pigs on that man's farm. Now imagine Jesus' audience in the year 30, an audience of traditional Jews who have lived their whole life observing the traditions of Judaism, keeping the kosher food laws, keeping themselves separate as best they could from Gentiles, never eating or even touching or coming into contact with pigs. And now this young Jewish boy had gone off to make a fortune for himself, to build a new life, and now he finds himself working as a swine herd for a Gentile. And I can imagine the collective gasp that might have come out of that audience as they heard how far he had fallen. He had transgressed the tradition. He had gone outside the bounds of what was acceptable. He was no longer clean. For all intents and purposes, he was now a Gentile. But of course, the end of the parable tells us that you can't go so far beyond the tradition that you lose sight of God. He was still welcome back at home. He still was the recipient of his father's love. He still was his son. He still had a place in the home, even if he still would have to work for the rest of his life for his father and then his older brother. That's the end of the parable, but that's not the end of the story. Why is it that Luke, in the 15th chapter of Luke, brings up this story about a young Jewish boy who transgresses the traditions and ends up feeding pigs for a living? What's up in the story? Well, later on in the narrative, at the climax of Luke Acts, in the 10th chapter of Acts, I think what is being set up at this moment in the story is finally resolved. It is now well after the death and resurrection of Jesus. It's well after Pentecost. The ministry to Judea has taken place, and the ministry to Samaria, and the church is on the brink of a new day. It's on the brink of taking the ministry of Jesus to the Gentile world. And Peter is going to be the one to lead that way. But before Peter can do that, there's a rather significant practical and theological problem that Peter needs to get beyond. And that is that the tradition says that good Jews don't have any contact with Gentiles. Good Jews keep themselves clean. They must observe the kosher laws and only associate with people who do. And so as we're set up for this story, Peter is very hungry because he's been fasting for 3 days. And he goes up on the roof of the house where he has been staying to pray. And as he is praying on the roof of the house, he falls into a trance. And he has something like a dream, a vision that God gives to him, in which he sees something that looks like a large sheet being lowered from heaven. And on that sheet are all kinds of unkosher creatures. And the voice from heaven says to Peter, "Get up, kill, and eat." 3 times he hears that command, and 3 times Peter says back to God, "By no means. I have never touched or eaten anything unclean." And 3 times Peter hears the voice from heaven saying, "What I have called clean, you must not call unclean." And this becomes the moment when Peter gets the revelation from God that sometimes traditions have to be rethought, reimagined, reinterpreted in light of the new missional opportunities, the new needs facing the people of God. And I think it's rather intriguing that Peter, whom the Roman Catholic Church looks at as being the first pope, is in the role of reinterpreting the kosher law and saying that that law no longer makes sense in the world in which they are now living, in light of the mission we need to carry on. God intends for us to move beyond that law and observe it in a completely different way. And that's the kind of situation I think the church is in today. I said that I'm afraid that Joseph Ratzinger may not be the right person for the job, and I said that I hope I'm wrong and I pray that I'm wrong. Because he is a man of faith, and because he is a person of prayer and deep piety, and because he has an outstanding intellect and can think clearly about issues, my prayer is that as he prays and as he reads scripture and as he studies the needs of the church and the world, that God might be able to break into his consciousness and, like the first pope, Peter, he might realize that maybe the world is calling for some different ways of understanding our tradition. One of the other things I do is I teach preaching at Pacific School of Religion as an adjunct professor. Don't teach every semester. But in the course of my teaching, on occasion, I have had Roman Catholic laywomen as members of my class, women who feel a call to ministry, women who are gifted theologians, women who feel a call to preach the word. And some of these women have been some of the finest students that I've had. But they are all struggling with the anomaly that there is no place for them in the ministry of their church. And yet, their church is facing a crisis because there are not enough men seeking the priesthood. And one of the reasons there are not enough people seeking the priesthood, you know, how many of us know clergy who are Protestant clergy, even though they grew up in the Catholic Church, because they wanted to marry and have kids and enjoy the normal pleasures of life? I think this is one of the issues facing the Roman Catholic Church and the new pope. One of the traditions that maybe it makes sense in this day to consider reinterpreting. Or what about the fact of overpopulation and hunger and poverty and the spread of AIDS in the world. In the context of a church that has been teaching for years and years and years that artificial birth control is wrong, based on what Thomas Aquinas said in the 8th century, or the 13th century, 800 years ago. With AIDS running rampant through Africa and telling people in Africa not to use condoms. Now, what's this about? Now, doesn't the Talmud say, and didn't Jesus himself teach, that any law must be broken in order to save life? So this is the challenge facing the church. And we have our own challenges as United Methodists, as Protestants as well. And again, my prayer is that this Pope's maybe opened the leading of God's Spirit, and surprising things can happen where we least expect it. The bottom line is, he talked about the relativism that plagues our society. And I agree with him to a certain extent. If we give up on the idea that there is an eternal one, if we give up on the idea that there is absolute truth, if we give up on the idea that there are transcendent values, that diminishes human life, and that diminishes the quality of life in the world. But it does not follow that the only alternative to relativism is insisting that we must guard the tradition and never let it change. There are other faithful responses we can make. And the bottom line is that Jesus wasn't about teaching orthodoxy, and Jesus wasn't about prescribing a certain kind of liturgy. They won't know we are Christians by how dogmatically and faithfully we recite the creeds. And they won't know we are Christians by how explicitly and faithfully we observe the sacraments. And they won't know we are Christians even by what political party we are a member of, because you can be a Republican or a Democrat and be a person of faith. They will know we are Christians by the way in which we reach out to people who are different from ourselves with respect and courtesy. And they will know we are Christians by the way in which we care for the needs of neighbors around the world. They will know we are Christians by our love. That's the bottom line.